سلام علیکم. سلام علیکم و رحمت الله و برکاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the worlds. And may his peace and blessings be upon our master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and his pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Before I start, just one small note in relation to last night's speech. One of the brothers advised me just to clarify this. Although the speech was quite complex in its own right, I did try to fit in too many things at once. In that evaluation stage of last night's speech, when I said that one shouldn't submit to the authority, be it of a Jewish or Christian or whatever authority, that means that when one is living under non-Sharia law, or to be more specific, a non-Wali-based Sharia law, one does many things, and they have to do it, which isn't required of them, like paying taxes and other things. That's what I meant by not submitting. Now here, many things you have to do. It's a law of the land, and even the Maraji say you have to respect it. That's from a fiqhi perspective. But that has its spiritual consequences. Living under such a law and authority isn't without its spiritual consequences. And that's why some people are uncomfortable. You see them every day. The fact that they have to submit, they have this discomfort when they speak. Anyway, the point was, when I say you shouldn't submit to the authority, I was focusing on the tariqa dimensions. The brother was saying that many people may take that as an ISIL ideology, and we have to go against and fight and kill and do that here. That's not what I meant. I was focusing on the spiritual aspect. Anyway, it was very kind of the brother to remind me of that. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. For the last few nights, we've been focusing on a prophetic holy tradition. Ma min mawludin illa yulad ala al-fitra fa'abawahu yuhawwadanihi aw yunassiranihi aw yumajjisani. Every newborn is born based on the fitra. We've explained that in the first two nights. And then it's the abawa, the ab, which has many meanings, parents, teachers, scholars. It's these classes of people that make one Jewish, Christian, or Zoroastrian. And we said we don't have to confine it to these three. Other systems of belief, Hinduism, Buddhism, all of them. Now tonight, I want to look at this tradition from another angle. And this is now focusing on Abawa as one's parents, one's genetic parents, and the role that they have. Because in the formation of the offspring, there are 1,001 parameters at play. Some of these parameters are more important than others. Even our ancestors have a role and influence, or had a role and influence, in the formation of me and you as the offspring. From generation to generation, responsibility exists, and their traits, not only physical genetic traits, but spiritual genetic traits, pass on. So this is before birth. Abawa, referring to ancestors, they have a role. In in relation to our parents, though, and their influence in relation to the formation of the offspring. Here, preconception, how they think, how they act, how they earn, has a role, an influence over the offspring. Even at conception, what they're thinking, how they're acting, what they're earning, their thoughts, at conception exactly at that time, has a role in the development and formation of the offspring. Then it's the 9 months of gestation, which maybe is one of the most important roles in the generation. Remember these terms, the generation, the insha, the generating of the offspring. It's that 9 months of gestation where the mother is generating the offspring. Here the mother has a very important role. How she thinks, how she earns things around her, and so on and so forth. But the point is, she's generating an offspring. This thing which was a unicellular embryo at conception, fertilization, becomes 3 kilograms, where she is granting her existence to the offspring. For 9 months. When something generates, when A generates B, when the mother generates the offspring, when A generates B, there results a unity between A and B. I'll speak more about that as we progress. It's a very delicate point, philosophical point, and explain in simple terms, inshallah. That those 9 months are very important, maybe the most important. Then it's the breastfeeding, 2 years, also very important. That too, like the 9 months gestation, the 2 years of breastfeeding, there's generating involved again. And if A is generating B, again, that unity results between A and B. Through breastfeeding the child, the mother is generating the child. In Arabic, they say insha'at, very important term. But whatever is the munshir, the generator, that which generates, the generated, that which is generated, is in unity with the generator. For example, our mind. Here we're creating thoughts 24/7. The mind, I'm using the term mind, I mean the nafs, but the mind is easier just to convey the point. The mind is generating thoughts constantly. It's never without thoughts, even in our sleep. Here the mind is the generator. The thoughts, the mental pictures and everything, they are the generated. There's a unity between the mind and the thoughts. It's one reality. It's a unity between them. Man arafa Nafsa faqad arafa rabbah. One who knows, has gnosis with the G, of one's soul, has gnosis of Allah. Or one who knows one's soul, knows Allah. Here, Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh Omri has given 100 interpretations of this. One of them is this, that the relationship between Allah and the whole of khalq, creation, is the relationship of the generator and the generated. And therefore there's always a unity between Haqq, Allah, and Khalaq, creation, other than Allah. There's always a unity. One's generator, one is generated. You know your soul, this aspect of it, that it generates. You know how Allah works. And he has 99 others. So breastfeeding, maybe not as much as 9 months of gestation, but those 2 years, the mother is generating the offspring here. And then when you look in fiqh, and you look at the prerequisites of the mother's breastfeeding, the question arises, they ask, what if the mother pours the milk in a glass and the child just drinks from the glass or the plastic bottle? Is that acceptable? Although this doesn't apply to the genetic mother, let's say in breastfeeding, ridha'i mothers, where someone, a child, breastfeeds from another woman, then that other woman, after, let's say, a 24-hour period of breastfeeding or 15 separate times of breastfeeding, that mother becomes mahram to the offspring. That mother now is called the ridha'i mother, the breastfeeding mother. They become mahram because that breastfeeding mother, after a number of times of generation, has acquired a unity with that child, and therefore they become mahram. The question arises in this scenario, what if that mother pours her milk in a plastic bottle and gives it to the child? Does the child become the mahram and that woman becomes the breastfeeding mother, the ridha'i mother? The Sharia says no. What's the difference? The child has to suck from the chest of the mother. It's a question of generating. Just drinking from a plastic bottle, nothing is generated. No mahramiya results. I'm just trying to highlight the importance of this generating. This ensure that the mother, the breastfeeding mother, gives over a period of time, not only one or two, the Sharia has stipulated, because the Sharia knows when that generation leads to that unity. And we'll speak about how important that is and how the attributes of that breastfeeding mother becomes transmitted to the offspring. Why? Because of that generation. We'll speak more about that in a minute. And then after breastfeeding, we have the first 7 years in general. Then we have a second 7 years. Up to 14 years of age, this offspring, its destiny has been in the hands of the ancestors, then the parents, then gestation, then the breastfeeding, and then how the parents have brought them up in the first 7 years, how the parents have brought them up in the second 7 years. They still haven't acquired that mature intellect yet. For the first 14 years, their destiny has been shaped by the parents. فَأَبَوَاهُ يُحَوِّدَانِهِ أَوْ يُنَسِّرَانِهِ أَوْ يُمَجِّسَانِهِ or other things. It's the parents. Look at the baggage that this child has acquired all this time. Then Islam says, look, the first 7 years you have to bring up this way. It brings up general protocol, general guidelines. The second 7 years you have to bring them up this way. Al-waladu sayyidun sab'asini. The first 7 years, the offspring, male or female, is the master. The They are the master. We have to let them be free. In other traditions, the first 7 years they call the child, the first 7 years, waladuka reihanatuka. The offspring in the first 7 years is your flower. Let the flower grow. Let it be. Stop imprisoning it. Stop disciplining it. The first 7 years, the child has to be free. No discipline. This is what many scholars have said. The tradition is very general. The interpretation may vary. I'm giving you this perspective. And some scholars say, let it be free. Don't discipline the child from 0 to 7. Why? They don't understand the language of discipline. And it'll have a bad effect on them. They have to release their energy. If you bring them to the mosque and they're throwing chairs here or there, well, don't bring them to the mosque. But don't discipline them in the mosque or anywhere else. You want to feed them? Don't say at 2 o'clock in the afternoon they have to have lunch. That's also discipline. Whenever they want food, they'll ask for it. You don't set hours for breakfast, lunch and dinner with children. That's also a form of discipline. The first 7 years, they are the Sayyid, they are the master. Okay, if they want to, they put their hands in fire, there you have to tell them something. But on the whole, this is Islam's line. Now, this doesn't work well when I was in America, because the system there, they believe in discipline, the earlier the better. Maybe in England they have that too. It doesn't matter what they say. Our scholars say this in relation to bringing up a child. I remember my medical days. This American psychologist in his book, he said, he was quoting a doctor. The doctor said, with every divorce that happens, you give me the first 5 years of that child, I'll tell you why the divorce resulted. MashaAllah, it's a very good statement. Now, he used 5 years, it doesn't matter, no, 7 years. We don't mean exactly 7 years, but what, if you give me the first 5 years of the child, I'll tell you why this divorce resulted. If the energy isn't released or liberated in the first 7 years, it'll accumulate, it'll release in a negative way. Now, some may say, well, the child will say, I want this sweet, I want that sweet. Well, if you introduce them to the sweet, it's your fault. If you don't introduce them to these things, they won't ask for it. But anyway, discipline, they don't understand the language. If you discipline them the first 7 years, it has consequences. Then the second 7 years, it says, وَعَبْدُونَ سَبْءَ سِنِينَ. The offspring now, in the second 7 years, suddenly becomes the abd. The slave or the servant. Or in that other tradition which calls them a flower in the first 7 years, in the second 7 years calls them khadem, which is like a servant. Oh, so it changes now. The second 7 years, they have to know who is the boss in the house, and that's the parents. They have to know who's the boss. Here, discipline has meaning. Now you discipline them. You don't hit them. Discipline varies from culture to culture. Punishing, rewarding, whatever system you use in your own culture, but they have to understand. First of all, their rationality, their intellect has reached level. They do now understand the language of discipline. But they have to understand submission. And who is the boss? Because it's in these 7 years that they're going to become baligh. Puberty will arise. And when puberty arises, you tell them now to submit to their Lord. They need some understanding of submission before they can submit to their Lord wholeheartedly. If that's not given to them, they're going to have problems with the Sharia. But I don't want to generalize, but these things happen. You have to know who's the boss. And then in the third 7 years, some traditions say, wa waziron sab'a sinin. They are the vizier, the secretary of state, in today's terms, if you like. The vizier of, in this third 7 years. And in that other tradition, which called them the flower and the servant, it says, that in the 7 years, the third 7 years, they'll either be a duwoka or sadiwoka. They'll either be your enemy or your friend, depending on the baggage you've given them for the first 14 years. It's no use to discipline them now. They're like a vizier, or like the prime minister and the secretary of state. The relationship is an advisory. They share information. They respect one another. You have to respect the child. You have to share with one another, advise them. Listen to what they have to say. They advise you. No one has the upper hand anymore. So if the parent suddenly brings their child to me and says, this is a 17-year-old, she's taken the hijab off, can you do something? I don't have a wand. There's no abracadabra in Islam. You had 14 years to nurture and generate this child. It's too late now. You just have to just continue with that compassion and pray that things will happen. But if you want to discipline them, it's going to have a reverse effect. So the point here was that look, the parent's role here, from preconception to conception, gestation, breastfeeding, the first 7 years, then the second 7 years, all this has a role. It's building the child. Now, this concept of insha is a very important concept, this generating. And with breastfeeding, the mother's generating the child in those 2 years. It's a school of thought. It's an educational school of thought, this. Try not to put aside this method of generating your child. Let the destiny of the child be in your hands. In adoption, for example, when a man and a woman, adoption is okay in the Shia school of thought, it's allowed. So a man and a woman, they go and adopt a child. And actually it's a very good thing to do, especially if the child's an orphan. Now, in this adoption though, let's say if they adopt a male child, infant, and they show it a lot of care, that doesn't cause any bonds of mahramiyya between the male infant and the mother. They still don't become mahram. Here, the mother, for example, sees if she has any famine. The wife, for example, the wife of the husband who now has adopted a son, or a male infant. In order to create that mahramiyya, she looks in her family if there's anyone with child, if there's anyone who's actually with child and breastfeeding. Let's say the wife has a sister, and the sister actually is with child, has a one-year-old, has a two-year-old, and is breastfeeding. The wife says to the sister, can you breastfeed also this male infant that we've adopted? Then she says, yes, no problem. After that certain number of times that the Sharia has prescribed that the sister of the wife breastfeeds that male infant, that sister becomes the ridha'i mother, the breastfeeding mother, and is mahram to it. And then that wife now becomes the ridha'i maternal aunt of that male infant. And mahramiya, the bonds of mahramiya, are resolved here. Now here, with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, both the mother and the father were ma'soom. 9 months of gestation of such a mother, 2 years of breastfeeding from such a mother. But all this aside, and this is very important, but we have something else with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which has this generation, which this, I don't know, it's very deep. The Holy Messenger of Islam would offer his thumb or one of his fingers, and Imam Hussein would suck the thumb of the Holy Messenger. Sometimes he would suck the tongue of the Holy Messenger. This is generating too, where the generator is the Holy Messenger. Not only was he generated from Lady Fatima alayhi salam, which is something almighty, not only was he generated from Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam, which is some very almighty, but he was also generated from the Holy Messenger directly, sucking his thumb, sucking his tongue. And in this generation, the Holy Messenger is imbibing his spiritual traits to Imam Hussein. Even more than that, the nature, the thought of the Holy Messenger, his nature is conveyed to Imam Hussein. And it's through Imam Hussein that the other 9 Imams result. Then we have the tradition, a very important tradition. Hussein Minni, the Holy Messenger said. Now this has meaning. Hussein is from me. He's the generator, he's the generated. It's a unity between them. He's from me. But the second clause needs interpretation. For ana min Hussein. And I'm from him. These things need research. What does it mean, this second clause? But this generating, it's important. This inshaa, it's important. I can just divert a bit here. Mullah Sadra, who is a very important philosopher, 400 years ago, he introduced this philosophy, which is on a par with the verse of the Holy Quran and the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, that an-nafsu, the soul, fi wahdatiha, whilst preserving its unity, kullul quwa, the soul, whilst preserving its unity, is tantamount to all one's faculties. All one's bodily and immaterial faculties, it is the soul. This hand is, whilst connected to me, is my soul. This hand, this living hand. Just pay attention, this is quite important. It has a lot of implications, very interesting implications, even within the Sharia. This hand is the soul. This hand is material though. Yes, it's okay. It's a material, physical manifestation of that immaterial soul. If you look at plants, they have a soul too. The soul means that source of animation. It's an immaterial thing. With plants, they call that immaterial soul a material soul. Because that source of animation depends on matter, existence-wise. You to take away the DNA or the matter of the plant, that soul will no longer be. And if it isn't, it won't manifest. It can't manifest. The embryo, the human embryo, in the beginning, has a soul. It's a vegetative soul. And its manifestation is confined to growth, nutrition at a rudimentary level. But the soul is manifesting rudimentarily. It has very few faculties that it's manifesting, generating. The source of animation, the soul of an embryo, it's generating. Whatever it's generating is in unity with that vegetative soul of the embryo. At day one, day two, like the plant. Then this soul evolves. As it evolves, it manifests in a more, it manifests more and more in different ways. Its jurisdiction widens, it has a more wider array of manifestations. Who is doing the manifesting? The soul. And then at 4 months, it becomes the human soul, where now, amongst its manifestations, is doing things voluntarily. Sense perception, touch, especially in the beginning at 4 months, it has touch perception. And as it grows and after birth, these become more and more, then rationality and so on. All these are manifestations of that soul. Because the soul has generated it. And the generator, the soul, and the generated over time, they're in unity with one another. They're in unity with one another. This limb is a product generated by that soul. It is the soul, but a physical manifestation of it. But the unity is always preserved. The unity is always preserved. Now, if you were to cut my hand and then my hand would fall, you're cutting that link of generation now. That hand, which has fallen down, becomes matter, qua matter. And that's not in unity with the soul anymore. Because that line of generation has been cut. That's nothing to do with me anymore. Whilst it was in the process of me generating it, and as I'm generating my hand, moment to moment, the soul right now, food is just a preliminary to generation. When we eat, that food isn't creating or generating my hand. It's the soul which is generating. The food has a role of assistance. The soul needs the food to do the generating. But it's the soul that is doing the generating. This hand, whilst connected, it's in unity with the soul. It is the soul. This hand will be resurrected one day, this hand. Not the hand after death. The hand whilst living, this will be generated in an immaterial realm. But after death, that body won't be resurrected. This hand, because this hand is a hand for soul, as a manifestation of the soul, whereas the physical corpse is a body, core body. It's not in unity with that soul anymore. Let's say if, these are all theoretical, although we have kidney donations today, if I were to be a recipient and receive a kidney, my kidney fails, it's removed. Someone's kidney now is transplanted into my body. That kidney, on day one, is not in unity with my soul. Because the soul is in unity with that which has generated all over my 40 years of living. That kidney wasn't generated by my soul. From day one, it's not in unity with my soul. It's not a physical manifestation of my soul either. But over time, medics say every 7 years, all our cells change, rejuvenate. Cells every day, every moment to moment, cells die, cells are created, generated, cells die. Over 7 years, none of the cells we have did we have 7 years ago. Over a period of time, with the generation of my soul, with this entity which has been transplanted into me, over time, it will be in unity with me. But in the beginning, it's not. Can we prove this? But Mullah Sadra, this is a theory. Can it be proved? Well, medicine has proved it. The body rejects a foreign body. It's the soul which is rejecting the kidney. That's why they give immunosuppressants. So that the soul doesn't recognize this body too much as a foreign alien. Before it becomes acquainted with it. You see? Why is the soul rejecting the kidney? Because that kidney is not in unity with the body, with the soul. It's not a generated product of the soul. And then more interestingly, with pig valves, heart valves of pigs, when they put that into humans, with the kidney over a period of time, you won't need immunosuppressants anymore. And it shows that the generation of the soul, over time it becomes one with the soul. That kidney becomes a physical manifestation of the soul. It's my kidney now. Imagine if I stole a kidney and put it on day one, it was transplanted into me. That person who I stole it from has a right to say, give my kidney back. And you have to give it back. It's not yours. But let's say if he came 7 years later and said, give my kidney back. You have to say, which kidney? That's not your kidney anymore. After 7 years, I've generated it. That has fiqhi implications. I don't want to go there. With the pig valve, there, today, modern medicine, it's interesting that the patient has to have immunosuppressants until the very end of his life. Because the soul can't be in unity with that pig mouth. It's all about in short. Now some people, they've acquired such a spirituality that even after death, they have that generating in short over their physical bodies. They're dead, but the spirit was strong. And they can still generate their physical body, and therefore it won't rot away. That's why we believe that the Imam's bodies are in peace. And that's why in the traditions we say whoever does the Friday ghusl until the end of their lives, their corpse will be preserved. Because they still have that generating power. They're still in unity with that body. It's that corpse, it's not a corpse qua corpse anymore. The generating link still continues even after death. Because they did the Friday ghusl until the end of their lives. Now this Friday ghusl isn't just a ghusl doing the physical actions. Ghusl has dimensions to it. When you're washing your head and neck, what you should be thinking. When you wash the right part of your body, what you should be thinking. Left part of the body, all this has inner dimensions. if those inner dimensions are incorporated, week after week, your spirit becomes so strong that it can still generate upon that physical corpse. Now, I'll end with this point, that with Hamza, alayhi salam, the uncle of the Holy Messenger, he was martyred in the Battle of Uhud. Muawiyah's mother wanted to consume his liver, and they cut him open. She put a part of the liver in her mouth. Then history reports, "Man lafadha fuhu akbad al-atqiya." She threw out the livers of the pious. And the famous Arif poet of old Sana'i, in one of his poems, he says, "Don't you know who the mother of Muawiyah is? The one who sucked the liver." Why did she only suck? She didn't consume that liver. She couldn't. She threw it out. Because Hamza, salamullah alayhi, rahmatullah alayhi, he had that inshaa, without a doubt. He was one of the awliya. He had that generating power. Although he had died, he still had control over his bodily, physical parts, and didn't let that happen. And Hind, the mother of Muawiyah, threw it out. It shows the power that he had. She's called, in some texts, Akilatul Akbad, the consumer of livers. But history doesn't report her consuming any liver. And even with Sayyid Hamza, it was only, she only put it in her mouth, she threw it out. So why she regarded as the consumer of livers, the answer is in the mythology. And we have to be careful with our actions, that our mythology reality doesn't become Aqilatul Akbar. Allah.